Technology highly impacts cities, you know that. Certain forms of technology you don't think about. Sewer systems. Early cities could not expand in size and in population simply because they didn't know what to do with the waste material. You can imagine what it was like when you just threw it out the window, and how many people can you have in a city throwing their crap out the window without the city becoming a real problem? The first people to use any kind of sewer system or water system, water particularly, were the Romans. They built aqueducts even before the time of Christ to bring water from outside the city into the city so that you didn't have to depend on well water. The aqueducts, of course, still stand. I've been to Segovia, and the aqueduct is totally intact. It's more than 2,000 years old. There it stands, no mortar holding up this thing. The stretches, I mean, the architecture and the skill, it amazes you. But when the water got to Rome, they then piped it into people's homes through lead pipes. This, along with one other fact, that the Romans drank their wine from lead cups, from pewter cups. You say, and this is supposed to be significant? You have no idea how significant. They drank their wine from lead cups and from pewter vessels, lead. And what happened was that the wine, the alcohol in the wine, interacted with the lead, producing a very low level of lead poisoning. Not enough to kill anybody, but enough to render the men sterile. So here are all these Roman guys drinking out of the wine, drinking the water, and they're getting this lead poisoning, and it's rendering them sterile, and babies aren't being born. Well, you got to keep the city going, because it's a big city. At its peak, it reached up to 1 million, which was incredible, because up until modern times, cities only ranged to about 150,000 at the most. Paris would be like 150,000. Rome, almost 1 million. And all these guys drinking their wine from lead vessels, from pewter vessels, and getting their water from lead pipes and lead poisoning, rendering them sterile, and they don't even realize what's going on. Children just aren't born. And of course, if the children aren't born, it's not that the men are sterile, it's that what? The women are barren. You know, that's what we mean by living in a male chauvinistic society. But the solution to the Romans was this. We can keep the whole city going. We can have city services provided. We can do all the things that need to be done, even if we don't have children. What we need to do is go out and conquer people and bring back slaves. And they'll do the work for us. And they would. The problem is that the slaves would drink the water and drink the wine. And the same thing would happen to them. So they'd send out their armies again, further and further and further and further, until you had, in fact, what we call the Roman Empire, which was constantly having to conquer other peoples and bring back slaves in order to sustain the city. And so I ask you, friends, I ask you, would the Roman Empire have ever come into existence without pewter vessels? Stop to think about that. And if the Roman Empire had not come into existence, would there have been that magnificent system of roads, that magnificent system of bridges that the Romans constructed that was unparalleled in history up to that point? Would there have been a common culture where everybody spoke the same language, where there's a common political administration that made moving from one country to another country possible? In short, if the Roman Empire hadn't existed, would Christianity have been able to spread as it did shortly after its inception throughout the entire Mediterranean area? In short, does not the destiny of Christianity hinge on one thing? The Romans drank their wine out of pewter vessels. You're saying this is getting ridiculous. Not as ridiculous as you seem. Another monumental thing for which no attention is given. I have never seen a monument in honor of brown rats. And we really should be grateful for brown rats. In the middle of 1400s, cities became almost impossible because there was a thing called the bubonic plagues. It wiped out half of the population of Europe and three quarters of the population of the cities of Europe. Nothing as devastating as bubonic plagues. The plagues were spread by a little flea that rode on the back of black rats. Black rats would come into the house. They would be in your, they'd run across your bedroom. They were all over the place. And so the rats being in close contact with people brought this flea that carried the bubonic plague into contact with people. And that's how the plague spread. Rats bringing this flea into the homes of people, and the flea carrying the disease, carried it from one person to another person to another person, basically made city life impossible. People fled from the cities. It was at this point that Rome itself became decimated. People just fled because cities were the places where the bubonic plague was most commonly evident. Then something happened, probably coming through Venice, probably coming from the east in the trade routes that were established because of the Crusades. Here's what happened. Brown rats came to Europe. Now, the problem is that brown rats refuse to live in the same neighborhood as black rats, and they're stronger. I mean, they're racist. You know, you got racist rats, you know. You think people are the only ones that have this problem. Racist rats, the brown rats, basically are territorially exclusive. They don't want black rats around. They drove black rats off the continent of Europe. One difference, however, is that brown rats don't like people. They live in sewers. They live in dark places. They live away from people. They disengage from people. And when these new rats took over the continent of Europe, the same fleas were riding on their backs, but the problem was simple. They were no longer in contact with people. And the plagues came to an end. So it wasn't great medicine. It wasn't great technology. It was the brown rats that did it all. What's even more important is this, that the brown rats coming into Europe meant that people weren't dying like they used to. Now, demographers will tell you the following. If the birth rate remains constant and the death rate drops, which is what happens in many progressive countries, you have a population explosion. What you want is the same number of people being born each year as die each year. Then you have a stable population. Got it? Measure. Is there a balance between deaths and births? But if all of a sudden the death rate drops, but the birth rate remains still high, you can see what's going to happen. And the population of Europe expanded exponentially. I mean, it went ballistic all at once. If following the bubonic plagues, the birth rates were high, the death rates fell low, and all of a sudden there was an explosion. Fortunately, the death rates fell because the bubonic plagues ended at a very opportune time. America had just been discovered. And we knew what to do with the excess people. Send them across the ocean. And we sent them across the ocean, not by the thousands, but by the millions. They settled this new continent. It was incredible, the number of people. I think in about a 50-year period, they exported something like 40 million people. And these people, of course, had children. One has to ask a very simple question. Here it is. Would the 12 continental states, would they have ever been settled? Would there have been this mass migration from Europe settling the east coast of the United States, creating America, if it hadn't been for the brown rats? So we like to think that George Washington was the founder of the country. We like to think that the Patriots gave birth to America. But I'm here to ask you students in simple language, would we even be here in the United States today if it wasn't for the brown rats? So the next time you see a brown rat emerging from a sewer, don't scream, don't yell, don't run away. Say, hail to thee, brown rat. We honor thee, brown rat. For without you, who knows where we would be. Oh, there's one more thing. You say, wait a minute, you got history contingent on Romans drinking wine from pewter vessels. You've got history contingent upon brown rats. What else are you going to bring to the fore? Answer easy, cod liver oil. There's another world-changing phenomenon that altered the structure of cities all around the world. said cod liver oil? Yeah. 100 years ago, one of the things that afflicted young women more than you can imagine was rickets, a disease that in fact affected bone development, particularly the pelvic bone. A girl would get rickets. Her pelvic bone would not develop. Consequently, when she got pregnant and tried to give birth, not only would the baby die, but she would die. We were losing baby machines, and we were losing babies at an incredible rate. That kept the infant mortality rate way up high. We didn't need concentrated cities for a very important reason. We didn't have the people. We needed the people to do the farming. But along came cod liver oil, which in fact prevented rickets from developing in young girls. The net result? Women who would have died 50 years earlier weren't dying. They were giving birth not just to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 children. My goodness. What would have happened if we hadn't had cod liver oil? And you say, Camp Paula, you're doing this with tongue in cheek. Kind of, but just kind of. The history of cities has been dependent on the control of the bubonic plague, has been dependent upon birth rates moving up, have been dependent on such things. So don't take these things lightly. Once again, these are the kinds of questions that you don't get in a history course. Granted, this is the kind of thing that sociologists investigate. You know, certain things happen. What history will say, there was a population explosion in the northeastern part of Europe. Because of the surplus population, it was fortunate that America opened up as a place for colonizing, and we were able to export our people there. They tell us what happened. Sociologists tell us why it happened. Remember, a description is never an explanation. That's why you shouldn't be a history major. That's why you should be a sociology major. Because we explain why things happen. Have you got that? It's very important. Now, when we start looking at these cities, just a brief history. The earliest cities were in Babylonia, and they were very small. I remember going to the Holy Land and visiting Nineveh. You remember Nineveh? Joshua? Jericho. I went to visit Jericho. You can still see the remains of Jericho. Incidentally, when I was a kid, this was one of the reasons why the atheists would say the Bible isn't true, because it talks a great deal about Jericho. There never was such a city. There's no evidence that such a city ever existed. Lo and behold, just a few years later, after I learned all of this in college, lo and behold, some guys were digging around, and guess what they found? Jericho. There's this whole area that has opened up called biblical archaeology, in which archaeologists simply dig around in sites that are described in the Bible and finding the stuff that the Bible says was there, and it's so amazing how often they find it. The Bible is an incredibly reliable book. Not surprising, since it was inspired by the Holy Spirit. But when I went to Jericho, I was so disappointed because I had this vision. I'd seen drawings of it in a Bible book, you know, when they give books to kids. And they show these high walls and this huge city and the children of Israel marching around, 300 of them. And they blew their trumpets, you know, Joshua fit the battle of Jericho, Jericho. And the walls came tumbling down. Well, I went to Jericho. You know what? Jericho is about 1/4 the size of this little campus. It's a tiny little place. You can walk from one end of Jericho to the other in about, if you really hustled, you could do it in less than a minute. This was a city. Cities were very small. I mean, you would never know that by reading the Bible, but cities were very small. And that's what the book will point out to you. The cities were very small because they had no way of handling excrement. They had no way of handling garbage. What cities really were fortresses. Athens is a good example. They built a city, and there was a city wall. But people who were artisans and farmers lived, what? Outside the city walls. And if an enemy came, You ran to the city walls, ran inside the city, and they pulled up the gate. And basically the city was a fortress in which you stayed until there was an end of the siege of the city. Of course, the most famous siege in Israel is Masada. In 70 AD, there was this great rebellion on the part of the Jews against the Romans. And it was a heroic struggle. And the last group of Jews held out on this mountaintop fortress in the city of Masada. It was one of Herod's vacation cities. And you can go there. It's magnificent. But a couple of thousand of them held out there. And they were able to fight off the Romans for a little more than 2 years. The Romans were all around the place. They had the place under siege. But the Masada had a well. And they could supply water and they had enough food sustaining there. The Romans couldn't get at the city. Eventually, they built this ramp, little by little, that enabled them to charge up on one particular day. It was a day in which the food had run out. They knew they were starving to death. A couple of thousand Israeli soldiers up there against the whole Roman legion. And this is a heroic moment. And so, in fact, if you know the story of Masada, because Jews love to tell the story, especially after the Holocaust, do you know what they did? Oh, you should know this story. They all committed suicide. Not so much committed suicide. They all laid down on their backs, and one man went around and slit their throats. And so the next morning, when the Romans charged up the hill, all they found were these dead Israelis. We would rather die than be taken into captivity. Do you understand why Masada should become a holy place after the Holocaust? Do you understand why they hold up Masada? When I visited Masada, a high school class was being brought up from Tel Aviv, and I kind of listened in, and the tour guide was saying to this group of students, this is what happened here, and then talked about the Holocaust and said, and that's why we Jews have this motto. Here it is. Never again. Never again will there be a Holocaust. From now on, every Jewish child will learn about Masada and knows what to do in the face of that kind of event, such as the Nazis brought upon us. We will not allow ourselves to be humiliated like that again. And you will not understand what goes on in the Middle East today unless you understand that the Jews have this sense of being embattled. They've lived this way for 2,000 years. Please understand the whole psychology of the Jewish people in Israel is they're out to get us. We must, in fact, make sure this never happens again. And one would say, as I would say, I think they go a bit overboard in it all. Not a bit. I really think they go very much overboard in it all. But that's the mentality. The city was basically a fortress. And if you go to these medieval cities, you'll find that they're basically on a hilltop and they have walls around them. My favorite medieval city. And I love to go to Italy. I like to go to northern Italy. I like to go to places like San Gimignano, like Siena, like Assisi, like Perugia. Any of you been to any of these cities? Oh, please go. They will, especially Assisi, because Assisi is going to pick up another theme. You know Assisi, the place of St. Francis. The city of Assisi is about, I would say at the most, 50 yards wide and about a half mile long. And it's a walled city on top of a hill. It was a city. It's a wonderful city. The reason why to go there is because nothing has changed from St. Francis's day except for one thing. Immediately after his death, they built this church. And people from all over Italy came to work on the church. Giotto, one of the greatest artists of the time, if perhaps the greatest Italian artist, came in and painted the frescoes of the chapel. There's an upper chapel and a lower chapel. He did the lower chapel, which is absolutely magnificent. And then there's a third level in which you can come and meditate right at the tomb of St. Francis. Francis is my hero. You have to understand. If everybody says, if there's anybody you could pattern your life after, who would it be? It would be St. Francis. I'm a far cry from it. I've indoctrinated a lot of my students when I was teaching here full time into being Franciscan. But they went and met with the Franciscans and realized that contemporary Franciscans are so far removed from St. Francis that they said, if we want to really want to be Franciscan, we're not going to live like that. We're not going to be Franciscans, you see. Franciscans make their own clothes out of burlap. But that's the real ones. The modern day ones buy them. And they're very expensive. And they're very, very chic. They're very, very nice. And they live in lovely places. And Francis is incredible. I would love someday just to give a course on Francis because I've read and read and read. I read at least one book on Francis a month because there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them. And the stories in Francis are absolutely wonderful. But Assisi sits up on a hill. And you think of the Bible verse, a city sitting on a hill cannot be hid. There it is, sits up there. And you wander in and you go through the gates and here are all these, there's only one street down the middle of the town that's wide enough for you to drive a car in. Otherwise, all the streets are little walkways going off in 100 different directions all around the place. And the cathedral is there and it's just, I mean, you step back in time. And here's what I want to say. The minute you walk through the gates, you feel you're being surrounded by the sacred. You say it's your imagination. No, it's not. People who don't know anything about Assisi get the feel of it. The dogs and cats that wander the streets are lovely. They've been taken care for by, you know, there's a story of St. Francis. There were shepherds that lived outside the city walls. That's where the farmers lived. And they had sheep out there. And there was this wolf that was coming down from the upper hills that was attacking the sheep and killing the sheep. And the shepherds decided to put together a hunting party and hunt down the wolf and kill it. And Francis says, please don't. Let me go out and talk to the wolf. And at the end of the week, if we have not changed things, you can go out and kill the wolf. Well, within a few days, Francis comes back into town with the wolf behind him as a pet. And the wolf lived in Assisi till the day it died, and the children of Assisi played with the wolf. The wolf had been converted. And if you go to Assisi, you can buy little statues of St. Francis. Now, here in this country, it's always St. Francis with the birds. In Assisi, it's St. Francis with the wolf. That's the great story of all of creation is waiting, suffering in travail, says the Book of Romans, waiting for people to come and rescue it. And that's Francis. I went to rescue the wolf. It's quite a beautiful story. I've got all kinds of stories on Francis that were equally as wonderful. What a wonderful, wonderful saint. But he lived in the city. There was another city called Perugia. You could see Perugia from Assisi because it sat on another hill. Perugia is an evil city. It was always the evil city. And there was at one point a war between Assisi and Perugia because each of these ancient medieval cities were city-states. They were like independent nations. Each city was an independent nation, had its own army. It functioned as though it was a nation in and of itself. Do you understand that? And so war broke out between Perugia and Assisi, and St. Francis was a knight. A young guy, I think he was about 19 years old, and his father, who was very proud of him, bought him the armor, gave him the spear, and he goes out to battle. And as he's going on the path, charging towards Perugia, he has this incredible religious experience. You'll love this story. A beggar is standing in his way, blocking the path. And he's begging. Francis gets off the horse, goes over to the beggar, and gives him his money. Little bag of money, gives him to the beggar. A generous thing. He gets back on the horse. The beggar is still there blocking the way. Hasn't said a word. Hasn't said thank you. Hasn't said anything. Just standing there. It's freezing cold. Francis gets on off a second time. And he takes off his cloak and puts it around the beggar to keep him warm. Climbs back on the horse. Hoping and asks the beggar to move, but the beggar won't move. He now has got his money in his coat. Francis climbs off the third time. Goes over. And he realizes that the beggar is leprous. He's a leper. And leprosy has eaten away part of his face. And Francis looks at the leper, puts his arm around him, and kisses him, the leper's face, eaten away by leprosy. Goes back and gets on the horse, looks down, and the road is empty. And Francis realizes it was the Lord. It was the Lord presenting himself as the leper on the way. Needless to say, this changed Francis' attitude towards lepers from that point on. He becomes the patron saint of lepers. They're pretty powerful stories. And when he finally does get to Perugia, the Assisi people are defeated, and he's put in prison. And he almost dies, and that's where he does more spiritual meditation. This is in the process of becoming a saint. And if you study how he moves from being a rich, spoiled, middle-class kid, and he comes back to Assisi, and he hooks up with his old friends who were noted for going through the streets of Assisi late at night, drunk, singing loudly, waking up the neighbors. Everybody despised them. And then, says one of his friends, we noticed that when we would go through the streets, Francis would linger behind. And at the end of the evening, he was always quiet and still. Finally, one day, Francis leaves the city and goes to this little tiny chapel just on the edge of Assisi. It's called San Damiano. He goes into this little chapel, broken down little stone building, no windows in the place. And he gets down on his knees, and there's this cross. Every Franciscan wears the cross that's a replica of the one that was in the chapel of San Damiano. And as he's praying, the Jesus on the cross speaks to him. And Jesus says, "My church is in ruins. Francis, rebuild my church." Francis looks around and says, "This place is a mess." So for the next 2 years, he's putting in plaster, he's fixing up this building, and it takes him 2 years to realize that when the Lord spoke to him, it wasn't to rebuild this building, but that the church itself had become corrupted and was in ruins and needing renewal. And the Franciscan movement started and really rescued the Catholic Church from total disintegration at a very crucial time in its history. Perugia, if you go there, you feel it in the air. Recently, there was a scandalous set of murders in Perugia. Didn't surprise me, because this is what we're going to say at this point. This is where we go into postmodernism, a postmodern understanding of cities. Cities have spirits to them. There's a spiritual quality to a city. In the ancient world, each city actually had its own god, its own deity that it worshipped. Every city has a spirit, has a spiritual essence. I talked about the spirit of Philadelphia. It's the Quaker city. If you get off the plane in Pittsburgh and you want to go down the escalators to the little train that will take you to the main exit, they will remind you that this is the city of champions. This is a city that produces champions, baseball champions, football champions, hockey champions. They just keep on producing championship teams. It's the ethos of the city. They don't win one World Series, they're multiple. They don't win one Super Bowl, they're multiple. And you say, what is it about Philadelphia that we never win and Pittsburgh, they always win? You begin to wonder about this. Is there a spiritual ethos to a city? One of my friends who taught in this program here at Eastern was into studying cities internationally. And he talked about Calcutta. I don't think anybody here has been to Calcutta. I haven't been. Anybody? No. Do you know where Calcutta got its name? It's a city that is dedicated to the goddess Kali. Do you know who Kali is? She's the woman of death. The woman of death. Right, warrior, death. Death is the name of the, it's the city of death. He says that you cannot get off the plane in Calcutta without walking off the plane and feeling death all around you. You wander up and down the streets of Calcutta. Death is at every hand. No wonder Mother Teresa goes to Calcutta. Bombay, on the other hand, is a city of entrepreneurship. It has a completely different spirit to it. Different cities have different spiritual qualities. And one would have to say, is this something that emerges sui generis? Or is there something religious about all of this? Are there evil spirits? One of the foremost civil rights leaders during the 1950s and 60s was a man by the name of William Stringfellow, who wrote a book, the title of which makes it worth buying the book. The title of the book is An Ethic for Christians and Other Aliens in a Strange and Distant Land. That's what we're supposed to be. We're not supposed to be citizens of this world. We're supposed to be citizens of another kingdom. We are to see ourselves as ambassadors in a strange and distant land. And he talks about the civil rights movement. He was a lawyer coming out of the best law schools in America, Bates College, then to law school, and then up to Harlem. This white guy, expert lawyer, became a lawyer that championed the civil rights people during this period of time. It was an incredibly effective lawyer. And he wrote this book. And the book is really built around an exposition of the Bible's book of Revelation. It's an exposition of Revelation. And he talks about two cities, Babylon and the city of God. If you go from the 15th chapter of Revelation to the end, you'll find it's all about these two cities. That here's Babylon, this evil city. And here's this other city, the city of God. You remember how the book of Revelation ends with, I, John, saw the new Jerusalem, the city of God, descending out of heaven. And so the question is, what does it mean to be a Christian? It means to be the citizen of another city, not a city of Babylon. I often say when I'm speaking, I love America. It's the best Babylon on the face of the earth. But it's still Babylon. It's not the city of God. The city of God is different. And what you see are two spiritual forces at work. Here's the spirit of the city of God. Here's the spirit of the city called Babylon. And incidentally, it defines urbanization 100%. Guess who loves Babylon? And if you read the book of Revelation in these last few chapters, the merchants. They've gotten very rich in the trade out of the city. They've done well in the city. But Babylon is presided over by a goddess, the great whore. The great whore of Babylon. Ah, what a brilliant description. Because what do whores do? You know what they do. And if they're really going to do well in business, they have to seduce people. And that's what the great city of Babylon is. It's a whore that seduces people. What is more seductive than a city? With all of its allurements, with its sparkling lights, with all of its excitement, Babylon, the great whore. And she says what? Come worship me. Come worship me. Come enjoy my delights, she says. Oh, that's the city. That's Babylon. That's New York. That's the great cities of the world. I'm this delight. I am the queen, she says. Come worship me. And in the end, it's a place of entertainment and delights. People dress well, it says in Babylon. Everything's beautiful in Babylon. But Babylon is able to survive for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that it consumes the resources of the rest of the world. As a matter of fact, I think it's about the 15th chapter. It goes down all the resources, naming them one after the other, after the other, after the other, saying it consumes ivory, it consumes gold, it consumes spice, it names all the things, lumber, it consumes everything. Cities consume what the rest of the world produces. And then one day, that's pretty descriptive of a city. And then one day, Babylon falls. Just in one day. And there are two reactions to the fall of Babylon. One is the merchants. Read the book of Revelation. Be sure to do that. The last few chapters. The city falls. And there are two reactions. One is the reaction of the merchants who weep, for Babylon is no more. Babylon that made them rich. Babylon that clothed them in fine linen and gave them luxuries. Babylon has fallen, and they weep and weep over the fall of Babylon. That's the first reaction. The other reaction is the reaction of the angels who are singing what? Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah. The great Babylon is no more. The great whore is dead. Now, I love America. I love America much. But you have to understand, if you go to biblical lands or the lands of the Quran, Muslim lands in the Middle East, they all talk about the United States, not as a nation. They call it The great what?
Satan.
The great Satan. It's the evil one. It's this evil entity that consumes the world's resources and gives nothing back. And one day it will die. And when it dies, we will rejoice. Scary, isn't that? I mean, if you want to do biblical prophecy, do it right. Do it in sociological context. Please read those last few chapters of Revelation and read it from a sociological perspective. What's going on here? What's happening here? And why does the city collapse? And what are the two reactions? And why are there two reactions? Basically, because the great city destroys the rest of the world. Point. Let's look at the great cities of America. And in your textbook, you're going to find stories about the cities of developed nations like the United States. We live off the exploitation of poor nations. Let me just cite two things, which you're going to read about in my book, Red Letter Christians. There are two things we need to be addressing. Political issues that nobody's talking about right now. The thing that I try to do in the book is not only deal with the issues we are talking about, but the issues we should be talking about. And two of the issues are trade relations and third world debts. Let's take trade relations. NAFTA. NAFTA is a free trade agreement. When you set up protective tariffs, so that stuff coming into the country gets taxed, you're going to create barriers to trade, and you're going to slow down economic development. That's the logic. But here's a problem. Let me give you the problem. The United States subsidizes American farmers. American farmers at the tune of about $18 billion a year. That's a lot of money. Farm subsidies, $18 billion a year. Now, here's the issue. Over in Africa, you got farmers in South Africa. You got farmers in Zimbabwe. You got farmers in Angola. You got farmers in Latin America. You got a problem on your hands, don't you? Because these countries do not have the means to what? Subsidize their farmers. The result is that wheat and cotton and rice produced in the United States, subsidized by our taxpayers' dollars, are able to be sold in third world countries at a price that is lower than the rice and the cotton and the wheat that is produced within the country. In short, you can go to South Africa and you can buy wheat from the United States, rice from the United States, cotton from the United States at a lower price than the cotton, the rice, and the wheat that is produced in South Africa. This is great for the merchants in the United States, isn't it? It's great for the farmers. It's great for the Chicago Exchange, where they trade on commodities. The commodity markets are in Chicago. handling the farm belt. It's great for them. Their money's coming in. Money's being made. The subsidizing of our products is making American farm goods available all over the world. And our technology enables us to produce more and more stuff with fewer and fewer people. And free trade enables us to sell this stuff overseas, undercutting the indigenous farmers, driving indigenous farmers out of business at a rate that staggers the imagination. I believe it's in South Africa that they lose something like 50 farms a week closed down simply because they can't compete with the products produced in America. Do you begin to see the problem here? And so there's all this talk about free trade. And there's a whole group of young people who are in favor of fair trade. Big difference. There's a group on this campus called Speak. Do you belong to it? Mm-hmm. Speak. Basically growing out of England, this British group that has now spread to the United States and has a chapter here at Eastern University, Speak, are strong advocates of fair trade. And somebody asked me on one of these television shows, so what you're suggesting, Campolo, is that we shouldn't set up barriers to protect products coming from the third world into the United States, but they should be allowed to set up barriers keeping our goods out. I said, you got it. That's exactly what fair trade is. You can end it all simply by doing what? By ending the subsidies. The steel companies in the United States have been put out of business not only because their technology of Japan is superior, because it's newer, as I cited earlier in our lectures. The technology producing the steel is earlier, but the Japanese have subsidized steel, which means that Japanese steel can be sold in the United States at what? A lower price than steel that's produced in Pittsburgh. And so it's no surprise that the Pittsburgh foundry should close down, should go out of business. This is what we mean by free trade. Now, who benefits from that? It benefits the banks of Pittsburgh that took all the money and built those steel mills over there. It helps the people who have invested in the stock market because we live in a quote-unquote global economy. So if you buy into a company that has its offices in the U.S., it doesn't mean its production is in the U.S. Nike does not produce its products in the United States. It produces it overseas, do you see? And so in a global economy, the people who own the company, the stockholders, they're getting richer and richer and richer, producing stuff in other countries where the production is subsidized. And among the poor, it's the other way around. I mean, you put it in countries where people are suffering from slave labor. Incidentally, in my book, Red Letter Christians, people say, well, what's the answer to this? I mean, what's the answer to the slave labor in places like Thailand? What's the answer to Filipinos working for 20 cents an hour? It's easy. Al Gore had presented the solution. Nobody's articulated it since Al Gore. It's such a simple one. International trade is largely controlled by the World Trade Organization, WTO. You'll see those letters around. Basically controlled. All you have to do is have a rule established in the World Trade Organization that any products that are shipped out of a country, see, we're not telling people what they can do within a country. We're not interfering with national policies. But if you're going to ship stuff out of the country, the products that are being shipped out have to be produced by workers who are paid a minimum wage that is internationally established. It wouldn't have to be much. If we made it $1.50 an hour, it would change the world. What's more is, it would keep jobs being shifted from American cities overseas. Because, yes, the labor cost over there is inexpensive. True, but the cost of shipping over and shipping back and maintaining offices, I mean, the cost of maintaining operations overseas is high, and it's only because you got slave labor that it makes it economically viable. Do away with slave labor with even a what we would call an unreasonable minimum salary, $1.50 an hour, and you'll change the whole world economy, and you won't have jobs being shipped out of the United States, and you would have workers overseas making a decent living. You say, but what will happen to the workers over there? Well, something's happened, and it happened so fast that the book you're reading doesn't take proper account of it, unless you have the newest edition. When the edition that I see many of you have was put out just a few years ago, 10 years ago, nobody thought about this. We were very concerned about blue-collar jobs being exported. Remember that? They're taking all the blue-collar jobs and they're shipping them overseas. And they're setting up factories in Mexico. They're setting up factories in Ecuador. They're setting up factories in Africa. And they're setting up factories and producing stuff over there and shipping it in. We're exporting blue-collar jobs. We are now exporting white-collar jobs. Because of the internet, white-collar jobs are overseas. So if you call Delta Airlines, the woman who answers the phone probably has an accent from India. I know it's India because that's where Delta has all of its phone operators. The high-level jobs are being shipped overseas. And what is even more interesting is that people in India are learning how to use the computer at a faster rate than people in the United States are learning. They are becoming experts in computer use. They're doing everything. People are hiring accountants to keep their books in small companies from companies in India. I mean, we are exporting no longer blue-collar jobs, we're exporting white-collar jobs. And so you put up these big office buildings in downtown Philadelphia, these big office buildings in downtown Pittsburgh, and one day you turn around and say, where are all the people? Well, they've been laid off. Well, who's doing the work? People in India. People in other countries. The computer has made it possible for this to happen. A whole structure of things have changed dramatically. I was mentioning to somebody at the end of class the other day that I was cleaning off my books. You know, every once in a while, you got to go through the books and throw out the ones that are out of date because if you're in sociology, that happens all the time. A book that came out in 1990, I pulled it off the shelf. It was called Megatrends. It was a bestseller. It was a brilliant analysis. Given our technology, what do we expect America to be in the next century? Megatrends. What are the trends that we can see inherent in the technology today? I just happened to look through the book. There was no mention in the book of cell phones or the internet. 1990. I mean, these are the scholars. They didn't figure that this would in any way really influence the direction of the world or what the world would be in the 21st century. These innovations sneak up. Technology changes everything and it blindsides even those who have great, great insight into the future. I mentioned to you the need to have fair trade instead of free trade. Another issue that needs to be dealt with, and this is the one I think we'll close on. I think we'll close on this one for today. It's a good issue to close on. The cancellation of third world debts. Now, if you go to the book of Leviticus, you will find that the book of Leviticus in the 25th chapter talks about three things that the Jews are obligated to do. First, they're obligated to remember the Sabbath. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Secondly, they are ordered to do this, to remember the seventh year. The farmer in the ancient world, the ancient Jewish farmer, was expected to leave his land fallow every seventh year. You see, if the seventh day is so that people can have rest and be restored, the seventh year is for what? For the earth to be restored. Don't tell me the Bible is not into environmentalism. It's absolutely required, according to the teachings of the Bible, that you be environmentally responsible, that you give the earth an opportunity to rejuvenate, to be revitalized, to come back to life again. On the 50th year, says the scripture in the 25th chapter of Leviticus, there must be the year of the Jubilee. On the year of Jubilee, several things were to happen. All debts are to be canceled. In a sense, in ancient Israel, if you want to go on a biblical economy, they were laissez-faire capitalists for 50 years. At the end of 50 years, you become communist for a year. And you redistribute all the wealth, and you start over again. All debts are canceled. Second thing, all land is redistributed. It goes back to its original owners. It goes back to those who originally owned it. And Native Americans would love this one, wouldn't they? As a matter of fact, there would be no problem in Southern California about Mexicans, would there? because this is land we stole from them fair and square. All land goes back to those who originally owned it. This is biblical justice. You know, you're talking about justice, Anna. This is biblical justice. Land goes back to those who originally owned it. Third thing, all prisoners were set free. You say, wait a minute, Camp Paul. Bad enough that you're turning the land back to the original owners. Bad enough that you're canceling all the debts. But you're going to let murderers, rapists out on the street? You're going to set these prisoners free? Don't get nervous. I have read the Old Testament. The only thing they put you in jail for in those days was debt. Everything else, they killed you. Every 50th year was to be a year of jubilee. Prisoners set free, land returned to its original owners, all debts canceled. It was like, okay, wealth has become concentrated in the hands of a few people. Let's start over again. Let's cancel the debts. I was very fortunate because I was a close consultant once a month, 2 hours, with Bill Clinton in the year 2000, which, of course, the One Campaign, if you're wearing a white armband, you're part of the One Campaign, had as part of its agenda the cancellation of third world debts. And so I banged his head against the wall on this one. You're going to the G8 nations. You got to cancel the debts. You got to cancel the debts. Why? Because if you live in Africa, 40 cents out of every tax dollar doesn't buy health, education, building the infrastructure. It doesn't do anything. It only does this. 40 cents out of every tax dollar simply pays interest on the debts that African countries owe to the developed nations. If you live in Ecuador, which is the worst, 60 cents out of every tax dollar doesn't even pay off the debt. It only pays interest on the debt. These countries are never going to escape from poverty unless the debts are canceled. And it's the year of Jubilee, Bill. Cancel the debts. Cancel the debts. So he goes to Birmingham, England, and he's confronted there with Speak and a bunch of other Christian groups who don't throw bricks or anything like they usually do at these world trade meetings. The WTO gets together. You know, whenever they have, there's a riot on the streets. Instead, they have a prayer vigil, thousands of them, out in front of the city hall where the meetings are being held, holding their candles and praying that God will lead these people to cancel third world debts. And Bill Clinton calls for the cancellation of third world debts, and the first country they deal with is Uganda. But they don't say to the Ugandan government, you're off the hook. They say this, you still have to pay the same amount of money, but it's going to go into a special fund that will be supervised outside of government control. And that fund will be used to do only one thing, to address the AIDS crisis of Uganda. You know what's been happening in Africa because of the AIDS crisis. And so with the money, they instituted all kinds of things, education programs, television shows on AIDS. Every school child was taught about AIDS. Condoms were made available. Clinics were set up. Medicine was made available for those who had AIDS to retard the progress of the disease. Within 5 years, the death rate from AIDS in Uganda had dropped almost 50%. While the rest of Africa has gone off the chart, Uganda's gone in the opposite direction. The cases of new AIDS is dropped even more dramatically. It can be done. People say it's a hopeless situation. We can turn things around. We can, in fact, change things. It can happen. You say, well, these countries shouldn't have been in debt. But they're not the ones that got us in debt. It was the dictators who borrowed the money to buy tanks to oppress their own people. It was the dictators who got all these loans from the United States to buy war material, to maintain their positions of power in this dictatorial fashion. Eventually, these dictators are driven away, driven out. There's a coup and they're gone. They're gone, but the debts remain behind. And it's time now to cancel the debts. Let me end with one little fact for your figures that you need to know. If you check out the federal budget and ask a simple question, what proportion of the federal budget is assigned to alleviating poverty in the world? It's not 1%. It's not 0.5%. It's less than 0.4% of the federal budget. Did you hear that? Let me say that again slowly. Less than 0.4% of the federal budget is allotted to help the poor of the world. Please note, the United States is 6% of the world's population. We consume 43% of the world's resources. This is what the book will point out, that the rich cities are taking the resources. Babylon, that's Babylon, the great Satan. That's why they call us the great Satan. Don't you think we owe something back to the rest of the world that's greater than 0.4% of our federal budget? Don't get me wrong. The American people are a very generous people. But fortunately, we have these nonprofit organizations. The church is a case in point. And if you go to these countries, what you will find is there's a lot of good work being done under the auspices of America, but it's not done under the auspices of the U.S. government. You find the schools that are established, World Vision, Compassion, they're touching millions and millions of lives. They're starting economic development programs. They're working for social justice. But the U.S. government is stingy. And we're saying, isn't it time for the richest country in the world to recognize its moral responsibility to share with the rest of the world a little more than 0.4%? So Bono comes to the National Prayer Breakfast. I'm on the team that puts that on every year. So I'm there every year. And the president's there and the vice president's there and all the, you know, Congress and the Supreme Court, they're all there. Ambassadors, heads of states from other countries come. It's wonderful. And the speaker is Bono of U2. My favorite line is, when the people of God do not speak out, Jesus says, yea, the very rock stars will cry out. You know? Bono stands up. And what a charming speaker. I had no idea he could be that charming. And he complimented the people that were there, church leaders to the most part in the audience, about 4,000 people there at the prayer breakfast. And he compliments them on all the charitable work they're doing and all the good they're doing through their charities, through their giving. And then he stopped and said, but I didn't come to Washington, D.C., the seat of power in the world, to talk about charity. And he turned towards the president of the United States. I came to talk about justice. Well, you know, you're great when it comes to charity. You're lousy when it comes to justice. And he said, this is what you're giving. Could you at least double it to 0.8%? Could you just double it? It would make such a difference. Studies done on world poverty says that if every one of the developed nations provided 0.8% of its federal budget, we would have enough money to address the poverty needs of the world. Bono loves to say, we have the technology, we have the resources, we lack the will. And so the church meets at annual meetings. And what do they fight over? How can we mobilize people to end world starvation? How can we bring an end to the poverty that's devastating this planet? No, we argue over whether or not Jack and John are going to get in bed together tonight. And Jim Wallace says, I'm a conservative on the gay issue. But if Jesus was among us, do you think his primary concern was whether or not Jack and John were in bed together or whether or not there was starvation in Haiti? What is Jesus really more concerned about? Cancel the debts. Institute fair trade. Introduce the technology that will keep people from moving into the cities. Don't allow the cities to become magnets in the third world of drawing people in from the hinterlands. Let's have a world policy that begins to address urban crises.